Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's guest is one of the funniest and most talented comedians alive. And not just because she does a spot-on impression of a clown horn.
If you don't like that, then you just don't want joy in your heart.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and on today's episode, I am joined by one of my all-time favorite comedians, Tig Notaro. This week marks exactly 8 years since Tig was diagnosed with breast cancer and delivered her iconic stand-up set at the Largo Theater in Los Angeles that began with the words, "Hello, I have cancer." Since then, she has pushed her comedy into fascinating directions, at times deeply personal, and at others incredibly silly. This has included a documentary about her struggle with wife and fellow comedian Stephanie Allen to have children. They now have 4-year-old twin boys. And the recent talk show Under a Rock, in which Tig tries to guess the names of celebrity guests who she doesn't recognize. Now she has a new podcast called Don't Ask Tig, in which she attempts to give life advice to listeners. It's hilarious. We talk about all of this and more on today's episode, and I can't wait for you to hear it. So here's my conversation with Tig Notaro. I'm so excited to have you on this show just because I'm such a huge fan of yours.
You're kind.
Has it been tough to be stuck at home at all, and especially not able to get up on stage, not able to perform in the way that you normally would be?
It's funny because I feel like I struggle with moments where I think, gosh, am I not a real comedian? Because after I had children, I was okay with scaling back my time and with doing the road or getting up on stage around town. And I felt really happy and fulfilled being home. And then I felt really happy and fulfilled when I actually went on tour and performed. When I do my local Largo show in Los Angeles, I'm usually on stage for an hour and a half, really trying out new material and trying to make the best of my time. And then here I am in the middle of a pandemic, and we're taking it very seriously, and we really are home. And I'm okay with it in that I'm really enjoying being with my family. And I love comedy. If somebody said tomorrow it is back, I would be thrilled to be on stage. But I'm also, I've been doing podcasts, and I have my own podcast coming out, and it fulfills the stand-up side of me to some degree.
Was there a time in your life where you really felt like you had to be getting on stage every night or you weren't fulfilled?
Yeah, I would say up until I met Stephanie, and I really wanted to spend the majority of my time with her, and I also wanted to maintain my interest and career. But I do feel like there is a balance that works for me. And it's not at all, I know there are comedians that are married with kids that are out at venues every night, multiple venues. And all I can say is we're different people, and I don't know. Stephanie and I share the responsibilities with the kids just down the middle. We're both getting up at 5 a.m. with them, and we're both making their meals, and we're both doing everything. So it's, and maybe the other comedians are too with their spouses. I don't know, but we are fully in it together. And I wake up at 5, and you know, even my Largo show that used to be at 8:30, I asked the owner, Flanagan, if I could move it to 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
But yeah, I used to get up numerous times a night and I don't miss it.
Yeah. Well,
but I miss stand up, but I'm also okay with time home. And it's giving me a chance to do other things.
Yeah, I did see that you do still have some tour dates on the schedule for the fall. Assuming that happens, are you working on new material? Do you have quarantine material ready to go? Or how do you feel about getting back up?
I feel great about getting back up. I'd be curious to see if those dates really stick.
Yeah.
And yeah, I have material from right now. I think it's kind of impossible to not. It's a completely new experience. Yeah, it's also interesting. I have a special that it hasn't been announced yet that I sold to a network before the pandemic. Actually, the day of the pandemic, the day that lockdown happened.
That must have been a day of mixed emotions.
Yeah. And then I also have a new hour of material that wasn't sold for the pandemic that I often think about. How do you return to that if I even do return to it?
Does it feel so outdated at this point just because of the last 4 months?
Yeah, it's really, but it's also something I don't stress too much about. It'll do what it will.
Mm-hmm. And now you have this podcast coming out, as you said, Don't mm-hmm. Ask Tig, which it's an advice podcast. Is that the idea?
That is the idea. You know, I think sometimes there's real advice given and then it can also go a little haywire, but I can't imagine that if people are familiar with me, that they would expect it to be one or the other. And I have noticed that over the years when I've guested on advice shows, that even when they're comedic, I really enjoy trying to come up with the best advice. I really want to help somebody. And I feel like I've had a lot of experiences in life that I wasn't quite sure if it made sense for me to have an advice podcast. But after I really thought about it, I was like, oh, I actually have been through a good amount of things. And I know how to navigate life pretty well. And if you find that I'm giving bad advice, then we can all point to the title, which is Don't Ask Tig.
What kind of questions have you been getting? Because I know you've already kind of started and been soliciting questions from people. And
yeah, a lot of relationship questions and a lot of how do you deal with people that have differing political views. And
yeah, that's a big one right now.
Yeah, pandemic stuff. And yeah, I think a lot of different stuff.
When you look back on your comedy career, do you have advice that sticks out in your head that somebody gave you that really actually affected you or changed the way you thought about things?
Yeah. I remember Sarah Silverman telling me years ago that it's good to, as a stand-up, keep options open to broaden your horizons if you have an interest in writing or acting or directing, producing, whatever it is, writing a book. Because sometimes it just can, the road gets kind of narrow sometimes when you're just doing stand-up. And I never considered that. And I'm thankful that I did take her advice because I feel like I've tried every avenue in trying it all. I've found what I don't want to do, which is just as important as finding. It makes what I want to do even more important and more fun.
What's an example of something you tried and said, that's not something I want to do again?
I would not want to carry a show by myself again. And when I started with One Mississippi, I carried the show myself the first season. And going into the second season, I realized that I have these stories I want to tell, but I don't. And I never have really identified with being an actor, that's my thing, even though I've enjoyed the acting gigs that I've gotten, including One Mississippi and now Star Trek and everything I do, I'm doing it because I enjoy it. But with the second season of One Mississippi, I brought up to the producers that I just want to not be so focused on me anymore. And I felt like my stepfather's storyline was just so compelling. And I felt like my brother's storyline was so compelling. And I felt like there was enough where you could move away from me. And I wouldn't have to be in every scene. Even though somebody would still be like, yeah, but you were carrying the show still. I was the star of the show, but it does not interest me to carry a show like that in that way. And I also don't really have an interest in, you know, wearing all hats at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine that can be a lot. I really loved that show. And I felt like, yeah, the second season, I think, got even more sort of deeper and richer. And then, of course, the show got canceled by Amazon and you weren't able to make more. Was that more of a disappointment or a relief at the time? Or how did you kind of feel about it not moving forward, given how you were feeling about not wanting to carry your own show?
Well, and again, I did want to carry. I still wanted the show. I wanted to do the show. And we had a million storylines for season three. You know, if some crazy world happened where Amazon or FX, like, oh my God, we got to bring back this show. Yeah, reboot One Mississippi. I would happily do it. And I would have a million things to say. And I also felt like where we ended on season two, even though it wasn't the end of the show, it felt like a reasonable place to end if this must be canceled. And then there was also a part of me that felt like there was an element of negativity that was tied to the show through a particular producer that I was kind of, a part of me was excited to just get that word of, okay, it's been canceled, and be like, all right, let's shut that chapter and I'm ready to move on in life. And that was in no way going to be the end of what was to come, you know?
Yeah. You felt like the Louis C.K. thing kind of hung over the show in a way that you didn't like?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was hard to do interviews without, just, he was just in there. And
he's always in the room.
Yeah. Yeah. And his name's on the episodes. And so it would have people be like, wait, why I have the.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm happy to move on from that.
Yeah, I know that's the case, you know, with Better Things too. Like, his name is still on that show, even though he has nothing to do with it. And so it's a very odd thing,
yeah,
I'm sure.
It's a weird thing. And so it's nice to move on. And let's say the craziest thing in the world happens and somebody brings One Mississippi back. I bet it would come back without that name on it.
Yeah, yeah. Coming up, Tig opens up about how the tragedy and illness that defined the earlier part of her career has given way to something sillier and more joyous, especially now that she's finally cancer-free for the first time in 8 years.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This episode of The Last Laugh is brought to you by Vanderpump Villa, a new reality show starring Lisa Vanderpump, now streaming only on Hulu. Join Lisa and her hand-selected staff at Chateau Rosabel, a glamorous estate in the French countryside. Meet the elite staff as they work, live, and play together 24/7. While dealing with rivalry, romance, and misadventures. As they try to provide once-in-a-lifetime experiences for their guests, the staff will need to meet Lisa's high standards. Not everybody has what it takes. Watch new episodes of Vanderpump Villa every Monday, now on Hulu. So, you know, you mentioned that you might be good at giving advice because you've been through a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the earlier part of your career, sort of the part of your career where you really blew up was so defined by tragedy and illness and all of that. And I'm wondering if it has kind of, how that affected your approach to comedy. Did it make you want to get more personal, or did it make you want to kind of push away from that at some point and say, I want to get sillier?
I think both. And that's what I'm always trying to do, is not have these definitive answers of what I'm going to do, because I, since 2012, and this is actually my, this week is my 8-year anniversary of getting my diagnosis.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, July 25th is my diagnosis date. And since 2012, I've had a lot of ongoing medical issues and pain and surgeries and hospitalizations and tumors and cysts and all sorts of stuff that...
That's no fun.
No, it hasn't been, but it's also created a lot of stories and humor. And so when it's made sense to share, I've shared. And then when it's made sense to pull back, because I am married with kids now, and I'm not, I feel like I have more than myself to consider. So I pull back, I think, on that level, where I share this, but I don't share that. Whereas if it was me alone, I would just maybe share everything. But yeah, I also love nonsense. I love silliness. And it was so fun when I was doing my show, which is, I don't know, indefinitely on hiatus under a rock with Tig Notaro.
I love it.
Oh, well, thanks. It was fun because even though it gives me the opportunity to be silly and nonsensical, there is still, it's authentic, it's real. I really don't know who I'm talking to. And it's also a really nice moment to connect with celebrities that are likely used to being recognized and being asked on a late night talk show what project is coming up, or what, who used a whoopee cushion, or what, whatever, you know, who was the prankster on set. And none of that comes up on my show. It's just kind of, who are you and what do? And what's your family?
I'm so fascinated by this show. And for anyone who doesn't know, it's you interview celebrities without knowing who they are, and then try to figure out who they are over the course of the...
In person.
In person, yeah. Which you can't do anymore. This actually, it probably could work over Zoom, the show, but it would be a little different. I'm fascinated by the logistics of it, because someone has to book this show and know that you're not going to know who the person is. So how does it actually work?
The producers put together what we started calling face sheets. And so it's just pages and pages and pages of celebrities. And I go through and I mark whoever I know and who I don't know. And then, of course, there's no name on it. And then they go out to whoever I don't know. They reach out to their reps and say, hey, this is the show. Here's a previous episode. And it's not like malicious or anything. And people have been so great, and they have a great sense of humor about it, not taking themselves too seriously. And I feel like the feedback I get always from guests is that they always say, oh my gosh, every actor should be on this show.
Yeah.
Just a dose of humility. But yeah, it's basically, that's how it's done. And with Kaylee Cuoco, who came on, they were so blown away that I had never seen her face. Or maybe I've seen her face. She didn't look even remotely familiar to me.
No idea who she was, yeah.
I can't remember if it was 3 or 5 times put her on a face sheet, because they were like, there's no way she hasn't seen her.
Like a different photo, maybe.
A different photo, different angle. And I would be like, no. And then they showed it to me and they're like, wait, so you've never seen this person in your life? And I was like, never seen this person in my life. And so, but she was so fun to have on the show. She was such a great guest.
Hi, welcome to Under a Rock with Tig Notaro. I'm Tig Notaro. I'm a comedian and I don't follow much pop culture or watch many TV shows or movies, so I have a really hard time recognizing famous people. But on this show, I interview famous people to try and figure out who they are. So please welcome this person. Hi.
Hi.
Okay.
How are you?
good. How are you?
I'm great. So happy to be here.
Are you?
Yeah.
I'm thrilled to have you here.
No clue, though. None. Right?
No, not yet.
No.
No.
Okay.
How does that feel?
It's new.
It's new.
Yeah. Yeah. I usually get it with the sound in my voice sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah, but maybe not.
Are you a singer?
No.
Can you sing?
No.
Would you sing?
I'll do anything you want me to. Absolutely.
Two, three, and. That's enough. That is enough.
I mean, you said, you know, it's different than going on a late night show, but I think you've been such a great late night show guest over the years as well, just sort of bringing a different energy to it than maybe some other people do. How do you approach going on late night shows? Do you think about what you want it to be before, or do you just really go on there and do whatever it is that comes to mind, or how do you think about it?
Well, I mean, they have the segment producer that goes over the questions beforehand and ideas, and I'll pitch some ideas, and then usually they're game for whatever. And I have an appearance on The Tonight Show coming up, so that makes me realize I need to start thinking about what to do. But yeah, I think I try really hard to not push too hard. You know, I feel like there's nothing worse than seeing someone come out just with their arsenal of bits, really. I'm gonna do something. I'm not looking to do that, but I feel like I have such a great, fun rapport with the late night hosts that I frequent. And there's playful things that I feel like will speak to our dynamic. And I'll be like, oh my gosh, this would be so fun to, like the time I acted like I got a text during my Conan appearance. I felt like Conan would be really great to do that with. And I just ignored him through the segment, essentially.
That's probably the show you've been on the most. And you guys do have such a great rapport. I think the one that really sticks out to me, and I think got a lot of attention at the time and since, is when you pushed the stool around the Conan set, which I believe is something you'd been doing in your on stage. But then it was kind of a bold move to do that on a late night set. Was there any pushback? Because I know you usually have to run those things by the producers, what you're going to do. What kind of reaction did they get?
I think that was the one time that they were a little hesitant, and I said, no, it works. And there are awkward moments. I've just been touring around doing this, and it gets awkward, but they come around and they're like, okay, you know, like, and it's such a weird pitch where I'm like, yeah, I'm going to just be pushing a stool around the stage. And the craziest part was, here I am trying to make my point that it works. And then it kind of wasn't working on the floor. I just grabbed the stool and I popped up to where Conan's desk is. And
that wasn't planned.
No, but I saw plexiglass and remembered that the floor is plexiglass with lighting under it. And I was like, oh, I bet it'll make a good noise on plexiglass. So I popped up there and I started running it across there, and it really made a noise. And Conan told me that to this day, the sound guy grabbed a sample of that and uses it to drive Conan insane from time to time, where he'll just, while Conan's in rehearsals, he'll play that stool.
I was performing in Seattle, and when I was on stage, I moved the stool next to me just slightly, and it made this weird noise, and it caused the entire audience to laugh collectively. And I was like, oh, that's all you guys needed? So I just kept pushing the stool, and they kept laughing. So I just kept pushing the stool, and they stopped laughing. So I kept pushing the stool. They started laughing again. And it just kept going like that for a while, a good 10 minutes. So I was just curious what you guys would think if I push the stool here.
Thank you.
like maybe some of you aren't into it. That doesn't offend me. If you're not, raise your hand. I'm not. If you want me to stop, a couple of you. Maybe it's because you haven't heard it enough.
So what I want to do now is just run through a few more highlights from your career that I really enjoyed and see if there's a story or memory that kind of pops to mind.
Okay.
So one is one of your earliest acting gigs, I believe, was playing Tig on the Sarah Silverman program.
Mm-hmm. Officer Tig.
Officer Tig, sorry.
Yes, that's all right.
What do you remember about that experience? And was that sort of a big deal at the time to be on that show and working with Sarah?
Oh my gosh, it was huge. I had only, I think, done one other acting job before that. And it was Zach Galifianakis brought me in to play this part on Dog Bites Man. And so Sarah had this role for me and I was so nervous and I just kept freezing up. And she was so supportive. I remember she... there's this scene where she opens the door and, you know, she thinks that she's attracted to me and I'm at the door of her apartment. When she opens it, I'm supposed to have this big monologue and I couldn't remember. And she kept opening the door and I was just silent. I was just like, I'm sorry. I don't know what I'm supposed to say. And she said, we'll be right back. And so she took me into her office or trailer and she just grabbed my hands and had me jump up and down with her holding hands. And she's like, we're friends making a TV show. This is fun. And I was like, I was so scared.
Tig.
Jay told me I could find you here.
I didn't think I was ever going to see you again.
Yeah, neither did I. But I've always been the kind of person that runs from anything real or pursues what I can't have. And when you laid yourself out like that today, I realized I don't want to be that kind of person anymore. I don't want to be that weird, lonely person whose only healthy relationship is with a dog. So here I am, laying myself out.
Wow.
And I really think about that all the time when I'm uncomfortable in an acting gig or feel like people around me are out of my league. And then I'm like, we're making a TV show. We're filming a movie. This should be fun. Let's wee. And I'll just jump around my trailer by myself.
That's great. Shortly after that, you made an appearance on The Office, again, fairly early in your career. What do you remember about filming that?
Oh, no.
Not good things?
No, it was great in that it was such a great opportunity and it was such a fun day, supportive, talented people. I worked so hard at, again, remembering my lines. And here's what goes back to Under a Rock with Tig Notaro. Yeah. I had not ever seen The Office. I've never told this story. It's embarrassing. It's funny. It's Stephanie's favorite story. I have never told this publicly. I had never seen The Office. I, of course, knew what The Office was. I knew a handful of the people personally. So I worked so hard on learning my lines. And then I was brought on set. And as I was standing there, I'm looking at an entire conference room of the entire cast. And that's who was in that scene. And it came over me that, oh my gosh, I don't know who to direct my lines at. Because I didn't know
which character was which.
Yeah. It didn't even dawn on me that... Because while I was in my trailer or wherever I was learning my lines, I was like, okay. And then I say this and I say this. And then when I stood in there, I was like, oh no, I don't know who these people are. I don't know who to. And I messed up several times. And I'm sure nobody in that room thought that I hadn't seen The Office.
Right. They just assumed that you would know who was
him. Of course. And I'm sure they were just like, what is her problem? Why is she directing that line at that
actor? That is so funny.
And I went home just mortified. I was so, and I remember I just told an actor friend of mine, or Stephanie just told an actor friend of ours that story. And that actor, who is a real actor, very successful, very talented, was like, made some comment like, oh yeah, I see you did your research. And I'm like, oh, right. Actors do their research. You know, I'm just going on set trying to learn my lines, and a real actor would probably watch the show.
Yeah, maybe see what the tone is.
Yeah. No, not me. I was just like, oh, cool. Yeah, I'll do. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for that.
Mm-hmm.
Very calm. So my apologies to everyone
that
on
is
the
hysterical.
Office.
So talking about Stephanie, you guys met on In a World, right?
We did.
What do you remember from working on that film and meeting her on that on set?
Well, I mean, when I was working on In a World, I had three deadly illnesses at one time. So I remember that.
That was right in that time, yeah.
Yeah, if you, the documentary Tig that's on Netflix, it shows that whole situation where I'm doing that movie, but all the while I have pneumonia, I have invasive cancer, and I had an intestinal disease, and I didn't know it. And so I was just lying down between takes, and I just thought I had some sort of bug. But Stephanie was my love interest, and we had a great time. I had a girlfriend at the time, which was about to end, like everything else in my life. But yeah, I wasn't looking at Stephanie as a potential person to date. I was just having a great time interacting with her.
Anyway, they're reinstating the hokey In a World gimmick, and everybody's in a huff, I guess.
Because it marks the rebirth of epic cinema.
Whatever. I'm just glad it's a woman this time instead of a sweaty old man.
I'll see you guys.
Yeah, congrats.
Thank you for the dropping the broccoli.
You should cut your hair.
Stop trying to woo me by being mean. Doesn't work.
You want to get a drink later?
Okay.
And then after I came out of all of my treatment and healing, I ran into her about a week later. And In a World was going to Sundance. And we exchanged numbers. And I told her, not even because I thought we were going to date, because I was single at the time, but I was just saying, oh, there's my number, but also don't abuse it. I was saying it in a joking way, but I was also really saying it in that I don't really like texting too much. And I said, yeah, I just went out with this girl that we went for coffee, and she texted me after the afternoon coffee saying that was so fun. And then she knew I had a show that night, and she texted me before the show saying, have a great show. And then I said that night when I was going to bed, I got another text from her saying, sweet dreams. And Stephanie was like, oh, don't worry, I hate texting too. And then that night when I got home and I was going to bed, I got a text from Stephanie that said sweet dreams. And I was like, all right, yeah, that's it.
That's very sweet.
I'm marrying you.
I know around that time or somewhere around that time, you were writing on Inside Amy Schumer. And I was just rewatching this sketch where Amy kind of pretends to be your friend and sort of takes advantage of your cancer.
But then that's when she said to me, I may be the one with cancer, but you're definitely the one going to heaven.
Aww. Who's going to heaven?
Hey,
you look great. Hey, what are you doing here? Shouldn't you be in bed or something? Look at you, your sad little wig.
It's actually my real hair, Amy.
What are you doing here?
I wanted to publicly thank you. Now that I'm all better, Amy has time to do anything for anyone.
Will you do all of our podcasts?
She'd love to. And if anyone has a web series, she'd love to do all of those as well.
All right. I'm curious, is that something that you wrote? And how do you kind of feel about that sketch now?
I didn't write that.
Were you comfortable with it? I mean,
I didn't write that sketch.
Kind of a dark premise.
Yeah. I guess I didn't really put too much thought at the time into it. And I just...
Did your role.
Did the
Yeah, moved on.
The sketch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Moving on now.
Yeah, moved on.
Yeah, fair enough. I also was just rewatched your most recent special, which I love. My wife and I watched it on a plane when it came out on a trip, and we were laughing really loudly on the plane to everybody's probably annoying everyone around us. We still ask each other when Yum Yum Donuts is opening. So
thank you.
But I wanted to ask about the Indigo Girls bit because I've seen you do it both ways because I saw you live do it where they don't come out, and then in the special, spoiler alert, but they do come out. Is it funnier to you when they do come out or when they don't come out?
I enjoyed doing it. I mean, I toured the country without them coming out, and And it was so fun to me to just, for those that haven't seen the bit, I announced that I'm closing my show with the Indigo Girls doing a quick performance. And there's just this mix of excitement. And then there's a dash of who are the Indigo Girls and why is this happening? And oh, okay. Well, there's just like this mixed bag of everything in the audience. And I tease it, depending on the show, I teased it anywhere from 15 to 35 minutes. It would really go on. It was still fun, even when they weren't there, to say, okay, who really wants the Indigo Girls to come out right now? And then everyone, like, even the people that didn't know who they were originally are now just like, please bring these people out, whoever they are. And then I say, if you want to see the Indigo Girls, then buy a ticket to the Indigo Girls.
And that was usually how it ended.
Yeah. And then and then I would leave just being like, you guys are foolish. Why would the Indigo Girls close my show? That is the dumbest thing in the world. And then I just go back to my hotel room and laugh to myself. And sometimes the best part too was I was playing the same venues as the Indigo Girls. And sometimes in certain cities, they would be on the marquee for the following night or in a few nights, and people would really be like, maybe they're here. And then when they came out, it was, you know, I had them come out before I taped my special. I also did Carnegie Hall, and I had them come out at Carnegie Hall, and I just sat on stage with them. And then when I filmed my special and they agreed to close my special, I was going to do it the exact same way as I did at Carnegie Hall. And as I was finishing my tour and getting closer and closer to Houston, which is the city I taped it in, I kept thinking, is there something else I can do to tie in? Like, and then it hit me. I mean, I play a little bit of drums, and I thought, what if I hopped in and just joined them and played the drums? And I practiced on my dashboard as my assistant drove us down the East Coast to Houston. And I just kept playing the song over and over. And I felt really embarrassed when I texted Amy and Emily and said, can I play the drums with you? Because it just seemed like such a bold move to insert myself into their...
Can I join the Indigo Girls?
Yeah. Because even though I tell everyone that when I was playing with them, I didn't even know it was a dream come true for me. I'd always dreamed of being the fifth Beatle, but I never dreamed of joining the Indigo Girls, even though they're by far one of my favorite all-time bands. And they were both just like, oh yeah, that'd be great. And it was so uncomfortable. We ran through the song maybe like three times before the taping. And I'm not going to say who, I'm not going to say which one. They're both wonderful people.
May have been the brunette, maybe not.
May have That's a call back to the special. That is one of those things where it's so fun for me to do as a comedian. And I think it's also one of those moments where a lot of people in the audience are
don't get it.
Or just it's not even the funny part. But to me,
it stood out to me.
Yeah, I don't know why it amuses me to say that. But yes, it could be the brunette. It could be the other one.
Yeah.
But when we were practicing, it was interesting to find out one of them really wanted to get it down. And so the pressure was on. I mean, it was like, you know, no, it's like this.
It was like whiplash.
The
drum instructor.
And I thought, you know, and the other one was like, ah, who cares?
Fun. Yeah.
And the other one was like, no, it's like this. It's like this. I was like, oh man. And so the pressure was really on. I think I pulled it off all right. I'm not a perfectionist.
The smile on your face really says it all when you're playing with them too. So,
well, it ties in the happy to be here, which was very much happy to be alive, happy to be where I am in my life, happy to be with the Indigo Girls. My dream, I didn't know was my dream, but happy to be on stage doing stand-up. It all applies.
Who here is like 100% sure they're not over here? I have to admit, You are correct. They're on this side. Ladies and gentlemen, you're still falling for this. I can feel, you guys are like, why? Seriously, are they here? What's happening?
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, just because I was curious if there are any updates on the show with Jennifer Aniston, First Ladies. Is that something that's still maybe happening at some point, or what's the...
Well, it's actually a movie.
Oh, a movie. Sorry.
Yeah, it's ready to go. I think that Jennifer has the morning show with Reese Witherspoon, and I don't know as far as the pandemic or the schedule of I know they were partly through the second season of the morning show when this all hit. And so I just am very much all for returning when it is safe, 100% safe to do so. And I know that Jen, as her close friends like myself call her, I know Jen is very excited to do the project, as am I. And I know Netflix it's a big priority for everyone.
Yeah.
And it's ready to go. I mean, the script is ready to go. It's so fun. I can't even believe that I'm hopefully going to get to star in that movie with her.
And the premise is that she's the president and you're the first lady. Is that right?
Yeah. She's the first female president and I'm the first lady. So, yeah, I think movies have a good chance of being made because they're so in and out. You know, if you have to quarantine and get tested, you can shoot a movie in a month or two and you can go take over an area.
Everyone's kind of in the same place together. And
yeah. Whereas a TV series, I mean, I could be wrong, but a TV series seems a little harder because it just goes on for, I don't know, 9-10 months. And I'm supposed to be going back to Star Trek, and they're in good shape in Canada, but you know, I have to quarantine 2 weeks there. I have to quarantine on my way back. It's a huge commitment, and I hope it all works out, whether it's TV, film, stand up. I believe it or not, I have a new career that's in the works. That's not.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like I said, this week is my eight years ago on July 25th is my diagnosis date. And even though I've been in remission this last May, my oncologist said that for the first time in 8 years, they're not watching anything. They're not monitoring anything. And for like, even in my relationship with Stephanie, she's never been with me where we're not waiting on results or I'm not going in for some surgery. And I had spinal fusion a year ago and I was bolted together because my spine wasn't healing. And then I just got news yesterday that after going in for scans, my spine is fused. And so I don't have anything wrong with me for the first time in 8 years. And so in my health journey, I have become very interested in healing myself and the power of a plant-based diet. And I started eating that way 3 years ago, and I've seen tremendous results. And I really am all about that. And I was reading this book the other day, a couple of weeks ago, a health related book. And while I was reading it, I thought, okay, what would it take for me to become a certified plant-based nutritionist? That's been my pipe dream.
That's your dream?
Yeah, that's been my dream for years. And people like Sarah Silverman, like my next door neighbor, they always contact me to ask what should they eat, what meal, what snack, whatever, to eat better. And I'm always trying to help and people trying to get toddlers to eat better. And I looked it up and I am in a 6-week course to become a certified plant-based nutritionist. And
incredible.
I'm going to start doing consultations. Aside from doing my podcast and hanging out with my family, I am studying. And I have a 7th grade education. I failed 3 grades, dropped out of high school. I got my GED, my CAT 8, my GED. It's framed in my office, half eaten. Mm-hmm. And I just want to get a certificate for plant-based nutritionist, and I'm going to hang it right next to my eaten GED, half-eaten GED.
You'll be probably one of the funniest plant-based nutritionists out there, I would think.
Well, that's what I'm hoping, is that I can make it fun, interesting, and give people some coaching, some meal plans. But man, is it, it's truly a dream of mine.
Yeah, wow. I had no idea.
Yeah, now you
it's
know.
It's very exciting. Well, Tig, you are one of the people who's made me laugh the hardest in my life. And we end every episode by asking comedians, who is another comedian who has really just made you laugh the hardest in your life? It could be someone close to you that you know, or, you know, someone that you've seen growing up. Who comes to mind as someone that just that makes you laugh like no one else?
Now, when I say this, please do not accuse me of trying to sound sugary sweet.
Yeah.
It is Stephanie Allen.
Yeah.
We are by far a normal couple with issues, problems, ups and downs, but we are going on 8 years and nobody alive or dead in any famous, non-famous, nobody makes me laugh harder. She, every day, I would say we have like streaming tear belly laughs together. And I never thought, I've certainly dated funny people, and I never imagined, because I've been surrounded by the greatest comedians of all time. They're some of my best friends and my heroes. And I never imagined that the person that I would marry would make me laugh harder than every single one of them. And I mean that so earnestly. She makes me laugh so hard, sir.
Thank you so much for doing this. And I'm looking forward to listening to your podcast.
Well, thank you for your time. Thanks for your support. And thanks for promoting my nonsense over the years.
Yeah, of course. Anytime. Thank you again to Tig Notaro for being my guest on today's show and for making me laugh so hard so many times over the years. You can subscribe to her new podcast, Don't Ask Tig, wherever you get your podcasts. The first episode premiered last week with Will Ferrell as her guest, and it is delightful. And while you're at it, please give this podcast a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.